This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 15th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Culture is brought to you in association with Persol. Hello and welcome to the 153rd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we're wondering, what's the point of music prizes?
There's a sort of level of cynicism. I think they're a good talking point. People like writing think pieces about why this year's brilliant, why this year's rubbish, who should have won, who shouldn't have won. And then they add to the discourse around music.
We're taking the temperature of a historically lukewarm art market in a hot place at Art Rio.
When you are in a country, in a city, in a state, where the market is not in its higher point, is the place to be, is the opportunities, new opportunities arriving.
And we speak to one of the finest character actors of this or any age, Stellan Skarsgård, pops by with that wonderful face.
Either he shouts, "Too much acting, Stellan, too much acting," and then I shout back, "Too much directing, Lars, too much directing," and that's how we work.
Plus, this week's Midori House session comes from Berlin-based pop trio Ballet School, and we speak to a Magnum Prize-winning photographer about Armenia's efforts to teach the art to budding shutterbugs. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Ballet School are a Berlin-based trio who play 80s-inspired pop music centred around the powerful vocals of Rosie Blair. After a chance meeting at a U-Bahn station in 2011, the trio have been working together and have just released their debut record entitled The Dew Lasts an Hour. This week they're in London to launch the new record and drop by Midori House to play a few tracks from it. Much toe-tapping was had, but sadly no pirouetting. We'll leave it up to you to pick your own style of fancy footwork to go with this. Cherish.
Thank you.
That was Ballet School playing Cherish for us here at Midori House. We'll be hearing from the band in conversation with Paul Noble later on in the show. This year, the Brits were the same old, the Grammys were unremarkable, Canada's Polaris Prize was quite zingy, and the Mercury has gone left field. So, whither the music prize? What are they for? What difference do they make to singers and to marketeers? Or are they just a journalist's dream, adding, as they do, to the discourse? With these themes playing out on the minds of the Culture Show, we invited Luke Turner from Online Wonderland, The Quietus, to tell us who the award for Best Prize goes to.
I'm a dynamiter. I'm a prize fighter. Ready to get sad.
They often say they're to reward brilliance. I think they're to try and sell records in an increasingly difficult climate for labels and artists, really. They're very well intentioned, particularly things like Mercury Prize, Scottish Album of the Year, some of the international ones. But there's a sort of level of cynicism. I think they're a good talking point. People like writing think pieces about why this year's brilliant, why this year's rubbish, who should have won, who shouldn't have won. And then they add to the discourse around music. If it's done well, I think they actually can kind of add to sort of critical discussion.
Yeah, I guess it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Everybody's got their view, and especially, you know, you want to maybe read something on The Quietus, or you want to read your favourite rock critic, your favourite music writer, I should say, having their two pennies worth, yeah, kind of adding to the discourse on it. You mentioned the Scottish Music Prize. I wanted to talk about whether you can funnel kind of quality, how helpful it is to funnel this discussion into nations and places and things like that.
I mean, it's interesting. I think to the Scottish music scene, it's kind of topical really with the referendum. I've always found the Scottish independent music scene to be amazing. The people are funnier, nicer, more entertaining than most of the... I'm not dissing anyone from London, but the Scottish have the edge, really. And I think they've...
There's a rich history of amazing indie labels.
Yeah, exactly. And I think they've always had to operate sort of on their own terms in Scotland, because everything's been focused so heavily around London, and occasionally Manchester gets a look in. So Scotland's always got on with it by themselves, and then they set up this prize a couple of years ago. I think the guys from Chemical Underground, really good Scottish label, set it up, and that's done really well. You know, I think it's created a greater awareness of Scottish artists, and you know, and Quietus has always nominates some various people. And I just think that it does help to sort of coalesce an area around it. And that's still quite small scale, the Scottish Album of the Year, but it gets quite a lot of press in the sort of Scottish media and sort of down here and online. And then you get ones like, I go every year to a music conference in Oslo called BLARM, and they have the Nordic Music Prize. And that's like a big deal. The Nordic music export is probably must be one of the richest export sort of communities in the world for music, and because they always fly people out and do all this. I've always found it slightly strange that the Nordic Music Prize is judged partly by non-Nordic judges.
Why is that? Is that about kind of like we can't really trust ourselves? We need to know if it's internationally, people are going to like it internationally.
I think that's the thing I find slightly odd about it, is it's kind of the focus is what can we flog abroad? We need to break out of
Scandinavia. Because it's about export, isn't it? That's the thing. That is very much about promotion rather than rewarding brilliance.
It seems to be more like that. Whereas, you know, I think the Scottish one seems to be a kind of enjoyably chaotic, what's the best, what do we like the most? The Mercury Prize seems to be like a kind of dividing up a country after a terrible war. Who should have which piece? You know, how can we allocate this? And it's all about... I think the trouble with the Mercury Prize, from what I can sort of gather, is it all becomes about consensus.
The Mercury Prize, for our international listeners as well, it rewards British music, but in a different way to the Brit Awards, which tends to be very poppy. This is a bit more avant-garde, isn't it? Or it likes to think if it is. Certainly this year, this is quite unusual.
It's quite left field and quite obscure people. I mean, I think it was set up as, you know, the Brits is basically, have you sold a ton of records? Here's a prize. And it was set up as a bit of an antidote to that. But then again, you know, Spice Girls were nominated for the Mercurys in 97. So you do get pop stuff. And Amy Winehouse famously sort of lost out to the Claxons.
Yeah.
And she was huge.
Do
you do get big pop acts in there, but it's supposed to be rewarding creativity. But you get the impression that things kind of get filtered through consensus. What can everybody agree on? And consensus is a terrible thing. It's why at the Quietus, when we do our albums of the year, we don't let all our writers vote, because that's why all musicians' end of year polls are the same, because you just get this sort of filtering down of consensus, and the sort of rubbish rises up because it gets lots of mediocre votes. And I think that's kind of probably how the Mercury works. I mean, the AIM Awards that I'm on the judging panel for, we have very heated debates on the panel for that about what should go in and what shouldn't. But you do tend to find the sort of more exciting stuff on the left field gradually gets wibbled away and the kind of bigger names come through.
Is that to do with the prizes and the awards themselves being, they need some self-publicity, don't they? So if you don't have a big name in there, people are going, well, what's it for? I don't understand. I've never heard of any of these groups. There's a weird way in which, I guess, the Mercury Music Prize this year has taken kind of a left-field approach. Damon Albarn's the only sort of big name on the list.
Yeah.
You know, as a solo musician as well, not with Blur or Gorillaz. And that's kind of maybe the Mercury kind of having the confidence to be a brand name in itself without needing the brand name of big bands in there.
The thing this year, I mean, it's, for me, there's only a few albums on that list I'm really into, but it is a more interesting thing. And there was a preposterous article in The Telegraph saying, it's all these misfits on the list. It's just a collection of misfits. Where's Ed Sheeran? You know, why? He's popular and he mixes together lots of things. You know, Ed Sheeran is awful. He's very popular, but it's not exciting music. He's a Brit sort of person. And surely the whole point of music is it's misfits make music. All the best music's been made by misfits. And it is kind of interesting people with quite different voices in the list this year. And it's a fairly diverse prize. The trouble is, as ever, there's no proper rock or metal in it. And, you know, and although dance music is a genre that's made out of tracks and 12 inches, you still get amazing techno albums and
that's
grime
the thing.
Albums.
What about
like
the album? Is it, I wanted to ask you, I mean, music prizes tend to reward albums, don't they? Mm. I mean, in the Brits, you have, and in the Grammys and things, it's best single and all the rest of it.
Mm.
Whereas this is an album thing. That's quite good, isn't it? To celebrate the long playing thing, to celebrate something you can listen to
Absolutely.
Over half an hour, 45 minutes rather than 3 minutes. I mean, that's something presumably positive. And that, again, is a kind of unit shifting bit of PR on behalf of the music industry that it helps to do.
Exactly. And it's, you know, I think that for all the reams that are written about the end of music and the end of the album, this, you know, people are still love making albums and they want to write to that format. And I think all the albums nominated work. They are good albums. They work in that format. They're great. Even someone like Kate Tempest, who's more normally a sort of performance poet, that record sort of holds together fine. You know, something like East India Youth, his album is really based around parts and suites, and it's properly structured within that.
Who's your tip for the Mercury
I would really like East India Youth to win. I don't think he will, because though he doesn't sound anything like James Blake, James Blake won last year. FKA Twigs is the one that everyone's going on about.
One who resonates that chase mouth open like
if I was a gambling person, I'd put my money on Kate Tempest, I think, because she ticks a lot of boxes. I haven't given it to Woman for ages. There's a sort of urban hint to what she does. It's very right on, quite political, and I think they might go for her because she's the consensus person.
I never wanted to be anybody other than the person that I am, and the things that I discovered in the circles that I ran have been difficult and humbling. Some don't understand, but I'm happy it's been struggling. Will all of us walk to our own beat? Each person's rhythm is unique. You can't hear somebody's tune if you're counting your time.
That was Luke Turner, Associate Editor of The Quietus. And after the break, we'll head to Brazil to take the temperature at this year's Art Rio. Stick around.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
it's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Last week, Art Rio wrapped up in Rio de Janeiro. Now in its fourth year, Art Rio has grown. It plays host to 100 galleries with everyone from heavyweights like the Gagosian, White Cube and Pace to the more local and little more niche galleries. This year's pickings for art collectors were impressive, with works from Baselitz, Andreas Gursky and Damien Hirst being amongst those up for grabs. Monocle's correspondent Sheena Rossiter visited Art Rio to see what might end up in some Carioca collectors' art collections.
Crowds of art buyers shuffle between exhibitors, looking to see which work of art would be the perfect addition to their collections. At Pier Mawa, a stunning waterfront venue located in Rio's up-and-coming commercial district, Art Rio is welcoming around 50,000 art enthusiasts during the 4-day art fair. This seems like the usual ongoings of any international art fair, but the fair is still in its infancy. Art Rio is only 4 years old, an idea that was born thanks to Brenda Valenci and her partner.
The idea was, how come Rio de Janeiro, being such a beautiful city with a lot of impressive content in art and very well-known artists worldwide, doesn't have an art fair? So let's do it ourselves.
After a year of planning the fair that was supposed to exhibit just 20 galleries, it quickly grew to 83. 4 years on, the number has now reached 100. Indeed, it's impressive growth in a short period of time, but Brenda Valenci insists that it's about showing quality over quantity.
You can say, okay, 83 to 100 is not so much growth in number of galleries. Yes, it's not, but we don't want that, because also we don't want to have a huge fair with a lot of galleries and the galleries don't sell. So we decided this year and last year and all the years to be very precise on the selection of galleries, of what with the selection committee, with which artists and galleries we think that the Brazilian market can support and can support the Brazilian market. So that's how we do our fair.
London and New York Pace Gallery is among the international galleries that has taken an interest in the Brazilian market as of late, a market that has a craving for contemporary art. Elizabeth Estev is the gallery's international director.
Brazil right now has, you know, every collector is building a collection more and more thanks to the fairs, which is great for them.
Pace, one of the world's leading contemporary art galleries, is known for its representation of significant international artists and estates, namely Alexander Calder, whose art proves to be popular in Brazil thanks to Calder's interest in the country, which dates back to the 1940s. Elizabeth takes me through the artist Pace Gallery brought to Art Rio this year.
We're exhibiting a total of 7 artists at Art Rio this year. Zhang Huan, who is one of the greatest artists from China, and also Sugimoto, who is a Japanese artist, Li Ufan, Nara, and we're also exhibiting Calder and Tara Donovan.
One of the barriers that has prevented international galleries like Pace from coming to Brazil in the past is the country's fame for high taxation, with art being no exception. Usually taxation on works of art is 40% in Brazil, but Art Rio managed to be a pioneer in the Brazilian art market by slashing that tax rate, which opened the doors to this art fair for more international audiences. Elizabeth Estev explains the benefits of the fair.
It gives the people that live in Rio the chance to be able to buy art at a special price, where they're not paying the taxes that they pay usually if they were to buy these works of art and bring them to Rio on their own, to import them on themselves. Through the gallery during this period, they can buy these works with a 14% tax only. which is a lot better than the usual amount that they would pay.
With tax breaks, bigger galleries have had even more of an incentive to come to fairs like Art Rio, and to come to a market that they were already interested in diving into.
Brazil is an extremely important place for us to be in. It's a lot about personal relationships, which we've been building on, and for that sense, it's been extremely successful and we're happy.
That's Peter Brandt, an associate director for White Cube, based at the Sao Paulo Gallery, which was only set up in 2012. Brazil is such an important market for White Cube that the Sao Paulo Gallery is the fourth White Cube location after the two in London and one in Hong Kong. In fact, White Cube actually opted to set up in Sao Paulo over the usual international art hubs like New York. But of course, White Cube wants to tackle Brazil and not just have a presence in Brazil's biggest city, Sao Paulo. Peter Brandt again.
White Cube always likes to come to Rio because there's a lot of important collectors here we always like to visit. So not only being in Sao Paulo, it's always good to come to Rio for our Rio collectors to see the works in person.
Most of the art being exhibited here has a conceptual feel that dialogues with Brazil's modernist movement of the 1950s and 60s, giving most art here a Latin feel, but one that avoids any Brazilian stereotypes. Damien Hirst, one of the big-name artists as being displayed by White Cube, used Rio itself as an influence for one of his latest works, explains Peter Brandt.
The newest series by Damien Hirst, which we'll be presenting in Sao Paulo on November 8th. It's a map of Rio, so he Google Maps and then creates out of scalpels, aluminiums, fish hooks, different pins and stuff like that to create these absolutely fantastic maps of cities.
Bringing an artist like Damien Hirst to Art Rio also opens up a gateway of culture to the Brazilian people, says Brenda Valenci.
We need to do this. We are a very new country. You know, people doesn't have access to culture. 10 years from now, it changed a lot, and we've been part of this change. During the whole year, we have programs to give access to art to people. And we can feel this change now in the fourth edition. We can feel the change of the public of the first edition that people would get in the fair and didn't know what they were doing there, didn't even know what was a fair. And now we see a public that is much more prepared, and even prepared to buy and confident to buy because they have more information.
And in a young market like Brazil, Art Rio is just the beginning of a brighter future for Brazilian art collectors. Brenda Valenci, again.
We have a market, but is this still a toddler? If I don't make it grow, it's going to be like this. And I believe also that when you are in a country, in a city, in a state, where the market is not in its higher point, is the place to be, is the opportunities, new opportunities arriving. So I think I convinced them with these arguments.
Though there does seem to be a dark cloud looming in this emerging market nation, which could put a damper on art sales. Just weeks before Art Rio opened, it was officially announced that Brazil has entered an economic recession after the economy shrunk for two consecutive quarters. All of this despite the nation playing host to the 2014 FIFA World Cup, an event that was expected to boost Brazil's economy rather than harm it. But galleries here, like Pace, aren't concerned that the newfound recession will hurt the niche art market, says Elizabeth Estev.
People will buy buildings, they'll buy very expensive cars in the city and pay huge taxes for them, and they're continuing to do so. And I'm not worried about the art market at all in that way, because they'll also buy art, and to them, it's an investment. They know that when art is sold at the quality that we sell it at Pace Gallery, it gives them an opportunity to own something that they know is not only beautiful, but it's something that is worthwhile owning. There may be many recessions going on in Brazil, but I haven't really felt it in the market right now.
White Cube's Peter Brandt also isn't worried about Brazil's recession biting into his gallery's sales at this year's Art Rio.
I think as long as you continue to show strong art, you'll always be able to sell.
For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Still to come in part two, we have the honour of meeting Swedish stalwart of the silver screen, Stellan Skarsgård. There's more music from this week's resident band, Ballet School, and we get a lesson in Armenian photography from Karen Mirzoyan. So line up your dancing shoes, blow the dust off your camera, and prepare for what lies ahead on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Michelle, Louis and Rosie are Ballet School and Midori House entertainers this week. They'll speak to Monocle's Paul Noble in just a moment. Before that, here they are with Pale Saint.
Ballet School, also known as Rosie, Michelle and Louis. Thank you for a fantastic session. That was quite a spellbound audience there.
You're very welcome.
Let's talk a bit about your group, because you've got three nationalities. You're all living in Berlin. How did it come about? How did this collaboration start?
Well, Berlin is this place where all sorts of people, like young people, are going there, I guess. Favorable conditions for being creative and...
Cheap rent.
And we all met there spontaneously. Like, Louis's been living there for 10 years, Michelle and I for a shorter time, but we all were there with like the concise purpose of like wanting to start bands and make music and meet people who are into music and art. And yeah, I think Berlin's the place that facilitates that.
What was the impetus for the group? Who said the three of us have got something which we can put together to make a sound?
All of us probably wanted to start a band. I really wanted to start a band. I met Michelle first, like on the way home from my bar job in the middle of the night, and like stopped to talk to him on a train platform because I heard him playing the guitar and thought it was incredible. all of us are pretty seasoned and like we've played music a lot, so we kind of know, you know, whenever you just know.
I heard Michel before I was in the band. He was playing at Rosenthaler Platz. It's easy to talk him up now because I'm in the band, so there might be a conflict of interest, but he was so good. I literally missed my train, a few trains, just listening to him play. The reverb in that U-Bahn is amazing. I saw them too. They'd been playing for a year and they played in a secondhand clothes store, just the two of them, guitar and voice, and I was blown away. Wanted to work with them immediately.
Let's talk a bit about your guitar playing, because you seem to have a really lush and distinctive tone. It's not, you're not just picking a guitar and strumming it. There was quite a lot of electronics there on the floor, and it was just very sort of very dreamy sound. What are your guitar influences? Where do you come from?
I grew up listening to British rock and pop. I was born and raised in Brazil, in Southeast São Paulo, and I spent a good part of my life in nature. And I think I draw a lot of my influences of just nature, insect sounds, waterfalls, this kind of thing. Like, it's my own interpretation of shoegaze, like a tropical shoegaze.
Sandal gazing. There you go. How did this album come about together? Was it a process of being in the studio and jamming, or did you have the songs written and then look to produce them?
We just initiated all ourselves, really. And we're kind of alone in our own wee world. We've created like our own wee world, I think, a bit, because we just write a bunch of songs, and I wouldn't say we jam, but, you know, like one of the things that we do is like we all like make music on our laptops, and ideas can start from there. It was trying to find a way to integrate that way of working, which is like a favorite. I think a lot of young bands like to work that way, integrating that with like the more traditional live setup. It's all about like self-sufficiency within the band.
And there is quite a sort of shamelessly pro-pop sound to your music. Yeah. You're not making underground music. It can be experimental and dreamy.
But you got to remember, we tracked this album in 3 days. You know what I mean? Like, it's, there's like understanding like pop structures and pop writing, but in terms of the production, like, this is not how a mainstream pop record is made, and this is not how mainstream pop stars are developed.
Why 3 days? Was that a deliberate decision?
Yeah, because that's what we could afford.
We've kind of got like that direction of wanting to be, you know, wanting it to sound like some of the drum sounds or some of the bass sounds, like some of our favourite records, and to take inspirations from lots of different places. But we're kind of also at the same time conscious that we don't have the means, we don't have the, not, I don't want to say budget, but time, or all this kind of stuff to get there. And we're conscious of that, and we're happy with that. And we're really happy that it sounds a little bit less hi-fi, a little bit less amazingly mixed.
I think the idea of why pop, I think, is just something good that you feel and you want to share. You don't want to keep it underground, you know. It's just love that you feel, and you want to spread it out, and I think pop is a good channel.
Louis, we have to just finally finish on, usually you play a full drum kit on stage.
Yeah, yeah.
Today, you had a little MPC drum machine.
It's the last time we're going to try and play 16th hi-hat notes on an MPC. My right hand index finger is hurting still. We're a good hour after session, so that's the last time we're going to do that.
That was very impressive.
It was fun, it was good.
That was Ballet School speaking to Paul Noble. They've just released their new record, The Jew Lasts an Hour, on Bella Union. Head to balletschoolband.com for more information. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I'm Robert Bound. Swedish actor Stellan Skarsgård first appeared on screen in 1968 and has since then appeared in countless films, including 6 of Lars von Trier's, as well as Good Will Hunting, Mamma Mia, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and Thor. His latest feature, In Order of Disappearance, is a whip-smart, brutally black crime thriller in which his character, Nils, is a carefree snowplow driver who will stop at nothing to bring his son's killers to justice. Georgina Godwin had the pleasure of meeting him here at Midori House.
When I started working with him, he was very insecure with the actors, and he didn't know exactly, he knew what he wanted and hoped for, but he didn't know how to get there. And he tried some mystical things, and he thought he maybe I'm sort of hypnotizing the actor. No, you're not, Lars. You're not hypnotizing us. So just don't say so much. So he basically now he says, at least to me, he shouts, "Too much acting, Stellan, too much acting." And then I shout back, "Too much directing, Lars, too much directing." And that's how we work.
So is it quite scary then being in an environment where actually the director isn't doing very much at all?
No, usually most good directors don't do much. They cast well. You talk about what is important for the scene, but they don't tell you how to do it if they're good directors.
I read that you don't even need to read a von Trier's script. If he asks you to do it, so for instance, an Nymphomaniac, you'll just do it.
Yeah, it wasn't written when he asked me to do it. I'm not doing Lars von Trier films because I want to make really good films. I do them because I want to play with them. I mean, we have so much fun doing it. I spend my life, I've done about 100 films, and I spend my life on film sets, and then I want to have fun doing it. And it's the same with Hans-Peter Moland, who's directed In Order of Disappearance here. This is my fourth film with him. And we are constantly looking for anything to do together.
Mm. So friendship's obviously a big part of it, which brings me to Good Will Hunting and, of course, Robin Williams.
This is a disaster, Sean. I brought you in here because I wanted you to help me with the boy, not to run him out.
You know what I'm doing with the boy.
I don't care if you have a rapport with the boy. I don't care if you have a few laughs, even at my expense, but don't you dare undermine what I'm trying to do here.
Undermine?
This boy is at a fragile point right now.
I do understand.
He is at a fragile point, okay?
He's got problems.
Well, what problems does he have, Sean? That he's better off as a janitor? That he's better off in jail? Better off hanging out with a bunch of retarded gorillas?
Oh, why do you think he does that, Jerry? Do you have any fucking clue why?
He can handle the problems. He can handle the work, and he obviously handled you.
Jerry, listen to me. Listen. Why is he hiding? Why doesn't he trust anybody? Because the first thing that happened to him, he was abandoned by the people who were supposed to love him the most.
Oh, come on. Don't give me that Freudian crap.
No, listen, Jerry. And why does he hang out with those retarded gorillas, as you call them? Because any one of them, if he asked them to, would take a fucking bat to your head, okay?
Terribly sad. Were you very good friends?
No, we weren't. We were close when we were shooting, as you are. It's very intimate working together on a film. But then it ends, and I haven't seen him since. And yeah, when somebody commits suicide, it's not the death that is tragic, really. The tragedy is that they were feeling so bad. And then the day after died Lauren Bacall, who I knew. But she was old, and her legs were bad, and she was probably hoping for it.
She, of course, was one of the true Hollywood greats. Was there something when you worked with her that really marked her out? Could you tell that she was somebody that had always had that in her?
She was an old lady, but with a grandeur, sort of a way of moving and talking that was just Lauren Bacall. That was fantastic. But being extremely famous in your life doesn't take you away from being a very normal person, you know. And she was the first time I worked with her, or the only time I actually worked with her, was on Dogville by Lars von Trier, and she and another fantastic actress, Harriet Anderson, they were basically walking in the background and sweeping the floor. But just being near those women is fantastic, and they're so cool. And I mean, I saw her when I was a kid. I saw old black and white movies where this incredibly sexy and beautiful woman.
Now, let's go on to the film that you're actually over here promoting at the moment. It's called In Order of Disappearance. It's directed by a really close friend of yours.
Yeah, Hans-Peter Moland. Together we have 14 kids, and he's got 6 and I got 8. And our families know each other very well, too. It's really nice being with him. He's a very different kind of director from, for instance, Lars von Trier. In some ways, he's the opposite of me, because I'm pretty fast and he's very, very slow. He thinks before he talks. I usually don't.
The film itself is extraordinary. I watched it last night. I'm still not sure that I understand it. I need to watch it a few more times. But I think maybe the thing about it is to let go and realize that actually, despite all its darkness, it's a farce.
It's everything. It's. I think it's very, very funny, and it's absolutely silly sometimes. I think the core is the leading character that I'm playing. I play him pretty realistically, and you probably feel with his immense sorrow and all his troubles. But at the same time, he's surrounded by a lot of characters that are like cartoon characters that are really over the top. It was very strange the first day. There's a man playing the real bad guy in the film called the Count. a very talented young actor. The first scene we had together, I stepped in and did my underplay, underacting, very subtle, very realistic. And he was so over the top, and I couldn't understand how we ever could be in the same movie. But Hans-Peter Molin was a very talented director. He found the form for it. And I think it's some of the excitement with the film is that this total blend and mixture of styles and emotions from sadness to absolute comedy and silliness.
You mentioned the Count. Now, of course, he plays a vegan crime boss. I mean, it is, as you say, almost like a pantomime villain. And then you've got the other one, the Serbian, who's this really old man that talks in a raspy voice. These are almost cardboard cutouts.
Yeah, they are. The Serbian boss is played by wonderful Bruno Ganz. And I know that the director, he just wanted to have... We don't have any scenes, really, but the director was so... He was so longing for to see me and Bruno Ganz in a car together, so he made the film.
Well, it absolutely works, doesn't it? And the sense of place, the landscape is extraordinary because it's utterly frozen, this huge frozen waste. In terms of, you know, revenge is a dish best served cold, very, very cold in this instance, because, of course, what you're after is revenge for the death of your son. Spoiler alert. Mm. But the landscape is almost a character in the film, isn't it?
It definitely is. The Oslo, it takes place in the as a city in the film, but it is digitally removed from its surroundings and it's put amongst the mountains in a very interesting way. But we were shooting at the top of Norway, high up in the mountains, and it was -28 degrees, and it was terrible, but extremely beautiful.
Very, very beautiful. And not only the landscape, also the interior decor. I loved the way that the two main villains were characterized by their interiors, by their soft furnishings, if you like.
Yeah.
Quite extraordinary. But let's go on now to language, because you hardly spoke at all in any language, despite the fact you were speaking Swedish, some of the people speaking in Norwegian, as we've said, and some, in fact, in Serbian. Very few lines for you, actually.
Yeah, and I like that, because unlike theater, film is not literature. You don't have to speak. The film we did before this one, Hans-Peter and I, which was called A Somewhat Gentle Man, when I read the script, I was the leading character in it, and I didn't appear on the page for 40 pages or something, because I didn't have anything to say. But the thing is not how much you say. If you know that you have a director that knows how to tell the story, he will put the camera on you anyway. And in this film, I don't say much, but I become the emotional focus of it anyway.
That was Swedish superstar Stellan Skarsgård with a rather smitten Georgina Godwin. After the break, we're in Armenia to discover the first photographic research library in Yerevan.
Nothing compares to a handmade wooden yacht, so say Bodrum's boat builders. Monocle travels to the Turkish port city to film the century-old skills still at the heart of the country's boat-making business.
The wooden bullets, they have soul. I don't want to say the other ones don't have any soul, but it's different. We fall in love with the wooden boats and we give our soul when we build the boats. It's like an art, every small piece done by hand.
Boat Builders of Bodrum, a cinematic portrait, now playing on monocle.com.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Now, the Caucasus Republic of Armenia is famed not only for its writers, painters and chess masters, but also for its photographers. In fact, the oldest photographs from both the South Caucasus region and the Middle East were made by Armenians. Curiously, though, there's never been much photography training in Armenia, a situation that Magnum Prize-winning snapper Karen Mirzian is eager to change. Our correspondent, Alexei Korolev, met up with Karen in the Armenian capital, Yerevan, where he recently opened what he claims is the country's first ever independent photo gallery and library.
On the surface, this looks just like an ordinary arty hangout with modernist furniture picked up from flea markets, photography books everywhere, and of course, photos on the walls. All this may be a familiar sight to Westerners or Russians, but in Armenia, that's something completely new. It has no official name yet, but many are calling it Mirzoyan Library, after its founder, Karen Mirzoyan, a Georgian-born Armenian documentary photographer and photojournalist, and winner of the Magnum Caucasus Award.
So this is it. This is your photo gallery slash research library slash educational center of sorts. Describe it to us.
Okay, first of all, I think it's a library. My aim was to open here like first photo book library. I'm a photographer, and I always see that in Armenia we don't have a good education in photography. Then I understand that if you even want to study, you don't have books. And
so this is aimed primarily at sort of young and aspiring photographers?
Yes, I always remember me 10, 12 years ago when I studied in a Caucasus Institute, and from World Press Photo, they sent us five or six books. And before it, I took pictures like for 3-4 years, and I thought that I'm a good photographer. But when I saw these pictures and with these books, I understand that I have a very big way to develop first. Like I understand that even I don't need a teacher, but I needed books.
And, yeah. And there's quite a few of them here, right behind us. Where are you getting those books from?
I'm buying everywhere where I'm traveling. Like most of these books are from US, from France, from Europe, some from Lebanon. I can say that these books are just books from different years, how I develop. For example, if first years I love to watch Cartier-Bresson, that's why I have a Cartier-Bresson. Now, if I don't know, watching like Friedlander, that's why I have now Friedlander.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned a bit earlier on that you traveled a lot. So this idea for creating this library, mm-hmm. Did you get it during your travels?
Oh, yes and no. Like I always thought it's important thing to have a good library, but I thought that maybe I will start to do it in maybe in 5 years or 10 years. But then how I working always on my project, I don't like to wait. I really like to act. This year I was in Beirut and I was in the Arab Image Foundation, and they have a very big and beautiful library. It's really affect on me. And when I come to Yerevan, I understand that I have to start something like project.
Do you feel like a pioneer?
I don't like to think this way. Why? Because I always trying to compare my work, if I'm doing photo project or this project, with the things that I saw before. If I saw something similar in France, of course bigger and better, I'm trying to be something like that. To be first, it's very hard work, because many people coming, they don't understand what's going on here. Is it bookstore? No, it's not bookstore. What is it? It's a library. Oh, okay, I can just sit and check the books? Yeah, you can, yeah.
Okay, let's talk about you, finally. These photographs that we see all around us here, those are by you.
Yes.
What are they all about?
This is a series from 2006-2009. It's a border, Turkey-Armenia border, and our border is closed for many, many years. And I just want to show the feeling of closed border. For example, that's why the all pictures are in motion blur, nothing straight and nothing like clean.
Do you envisage this place also as a staging platform or gallery for other photographers to have their exhibitions here?
Yes, one of my aims here with the gallery part is to show only like very good quality of photography. It doesn't mean only like conceptual, but also about the good prints. We don't have a place where you can print pictures like in a real quality, in right quality. And that's why, for example, this picture I print in France, and other my exhibition I print in Europe or in the US.
What are your hopes and visions for this place? Do you want it to grow, to expand into something bigger?
For me, the most important thing to expand library. It means that if we will have near 20 books per month in library, we can say in Armenia, it will be very cool. And also education, I will try to bring and invite different people, curators and photographers, art photographers, documentary photographers for a workshop and masterclasses. Gallery for me more like secondary, but library and education first.
Thanks, Alexi. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher, and she puts all those things in capital letters that she thinks I can't pronounce. Write in if I've said your name wrong. Time for one final song. Here's Ballet School with Lux. Thanks, as ever, for tuning in.
Forever, feel your love, and baby.